Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Desmond, Kamau just got here, so we got to stop talking shit about him.
11 me, Kamau.
Oh, I know. It's on tape. It's on tape.
From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell, and I'm doing the opening a little bit bigger because I heard it last week and I sounded sad.
Man, I'm glad you're standing up for yourself and you're trying to make an imprint right off the top. And I'm Hari Kondabolu.
We're two friends and stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
And that's why we're bringing back guests like Desmond Mead, who led the fight to re-enfranchise people with past felony convictions in Florida.
Voting is the difference between life and death, and we are experiencing things right now that's a direct result of our level of voter participation.
The fight for voting rights is happening all over the country in Republican-led states, including Florida, Georgia, and Arizona. Florida is considering new legislation to make voting harder. And when states do that, they tend to be states led by Republicans, and they tend to want to make the voting harder on the black and brown folks. And Florida's no different. I'm looking at you, Ron DeSantis. Actually, I really don't like looking at you, Ron DeSantis.
That's why Desmond has been doing the real work of uprooting white supremacy, just the kind of work Soledad O'Brien is highlighting in her new series on BET, Disrupt and Dismantle.
Professional segue from Hari Kondabolu.
Thank you. I've been practicing.
Soledad O'Brien has been an anchor and correspondent for many of the biggest alphabet networks, NBC, MSNBC, HBO, a network called CNN. Soledad has always made the inequalities of race and class central to her reporting, but now she not only wants to reveal the realities of structural racism, but she wants to talk about how we rip it up and create a whole new system.
She's calling out some of her old employers, and perhaps one of our current employers, for their role in spreading disinformation and encouraging extremism.
Why? Why are you putting people on TV who lie? Why are you not framing them as this is a person who's been dishonest in the past? You should know that because it's relevant to the conversation we're having.
I'm sorry, say what now?
She's calling out some of her old employers, and I think one of us is employed by one of those alphabet networks.
It's all... Well, it's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
What was that show you used to have on CNN? United Shades of...
To paraphrase Mitch Hedberg, I used to have it, and I still do.
Hey, Kamau.
Hey, what's up, sir?
I've been on a diet. I haven't made that public, really, but I've been on a diet. I'm not going to tell you which company I'm Good. Using, but let's Good. Just say they've rebranded and I would be a spokesperson. I would gladly be a spokesperson. It's been very effective. Mm. I have been consistently full, which is new for me in dieting. I feel okay. full. Okay. I have lost some weight. I have a healthier mindset and attitude. And once again, would love to make money as the spokesperson for this weight loss company that has recently rebranded to two letters. So I'm just putting that out there. But yeah,
is it a weight loss company that Wonder Woman could conveniently endorse because it wouldn't mess with her own branding?
Yes, potentially. Yes, okay. That would actually make sense considering their initials. You remember lunch dessert and how I ate lunch?
Oh yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, Kamau. During COVID, it led to breakfast dessert as well.
Breakfast dessert. So for people who don't understand, lunch dessert is just the standard practice of having dessert when you have lunch.
Which implies that you're also having it for dinner. You're having both.
Yeah, no, it also just implies that you're thinking about it. Like, it's not like a thing that is like, maybe I'll have... Oh, because a lot of people, I think, have lunch and they go, I'll have a sweet treat, maybe later, 2, 3 o'clock, you know, when I have that 5-hour energy drink. But you're actually saying, no, a part of lunch is a thing called lunch dessert.
Yes. Well, this is partly your fault because, you know, when I was a writer on your legendary FX series, Totally Biased, there was, when we had catered meals, lunch dessert was always provided. And it was to taunt me. Because nobody would eat the dessert as much as I did. I would go for thirds and fourths.
Yes, so.
So anyway, I cut lunch dessert. I cut breakfast dessert. Which breakfast dessert's really upsetting because a muffin is already kind of like cake. And then you add another thing after the cake. And then, you know, dinner dessert. So now if I have dinner dessert, it's usually fruit with a little whipped cream.
All right. Fruit with whipped cream. Wow. I mean, are you going to bed at like 6:30? Because that sounds like an old person.
Fruit with whipped cream. It's a little old people-y. But I love it. You know, I try. If you haven't tried fruit. Also, if you don't eat chocolate or processed sugar for a couple of weeks, fruit tastes amazing. Mm. Oh, it's so sweet. I couldn't believe it. Like, this is a strawberry? This is so much better than strawberry Starburst. I could have sworn strawberry Starburst was better, but I was wrong.
I just want to help you out because I'm sure you're going to hear from some people. You don't really want to frame what you're doing as a diet.
Okay.
Because that implies somehow that there's something wrong or that you're trying to, or that it really focuses on the losing weight part and not the sort of like healthy eating, not the healthy eating part. If you eat healthy, your body will sort of settle at the whatever shape it's supposed to be at and not so much like I'm trying to get down to some sort of imaginary weight that I used to be in high school when I was a completely different person with a different metabolism.
Honestly, that's very similar to the philosophy of this unnamed weight loss program.
Okay.
It's all about like mental health and checking in with yourself. But yeah, it's mostly because I'm afraid of dying. And I want to be healthier. I don't feel healthy. I'm trying to be healthy about it. And I'm sharing this with the public because I trust all of you, even though that's bit me in the ass before.
Yeah, no, that's not a good idea.
Well, let's do it. Let's see what happens. I want to see encouraging tweets, but we'll see what happens. I don't always trust our listeners.
I also am a person who, I think, when I think about the last year, it's been a year since the pandemic started. It's been over a year now. Well, depending upon when you mark it, I mark it on the day the NBA shut down, as I talked about last year, or last episode.
Was it March 11th?
March 11th. Yeah, that's my 1 year of the pandemic. And so I like had this moment where I sort of checked in with my body and looked around. I was like, oh my God, I've had like the most sedentary year I've ever had in my life. And just like the most sort of like solitary year that I've had in my life, you know, other than I'm zooming with the best of them, but just as far as like seeing friends, and I think a lot of people's fishing, and I had this moment of like, oh my God, I need to like go to the doctor and just like see if I'm okay. In a real moment of like actual panic, like, have I destroyed myself? You know, is this the 1 year where I destroyed my body? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'll let you know. I did go to the doctor and I had some blood tests taken, but I'll let you know if it's over for me.
Stay tuned. Kamau, I don't think they'll let me do the podcast by myself. I also worry about you. Also you. Also, I'm concerned about
also,
you.
Also, yeah. No, that's fair. That's father speak. That's fair. I'm not mad at that.
My son, please.
Yeah. that's father talk. I'm not mad at that. Part of the thing I'm also doing is my mental health, you know, it's easy to take in a lot of negative information right now, which is part of our job and also who we would be in the world, even if we didn't have these jobs. And
that's
so
correct.
There's just always a flood. Like, this was the past week was like a year since Breonna Taylor was killed. There was like this story that came out about Mississippi, the government of Mississippi, not taking federal money from expand Medicaid because he's a Republican and he went, blah, 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 which is totally racist because the money would help Black folks in Mississippi and also white folks, but he doesn't care.
You know it's racist because who doesn't take free money?
Yeah, no, exactly. What Republican doesn't take free money? So, but in the midst of that, I've discovered something that makes me very happy in a way that is somewhat weird. Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak have a supergroup called Silk Sonic. What? And they've released one song. It's called Leave Your Door Open. Which is just glorious. And I'm not even a fan of like I listen to R&B, but it's like, it's a glorious, glorious song. They performed at the Grammys. I actually tweeted about it. I was like, they're coming up next. Like, I was very excited. I don't watch the Grammys live. I wait till the Monday, but I heard they were performing. So the look on your face tells me you have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, honestly, the song I've heard the most recently is Baby Beluga by Raffi. Oh, yeah.
Wow. I mean, Raffi's great. I mean, I'm a fan. But Silk Sonic, it feels like a 21st century anthem in a post-Me Too world is how I'll say it.
Huh.
Basically, the whole song is like, I'll leave my door open if you're interested in coming over. Like, it's just like, it's a very, like, it's Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak saying, like, I've got my pool is heated. I've got filet steaks. I've got some weed. I'm all set up. And if you're interested in coming over, please do.
But no pressure.
And it's also done in the style of like early 70s soul music. So it's very like sort of languid and sensual, but in a way that is not like sort of like the you know, unch. The video is great. I've gotten into not only watching the video of the song, but reaction videos are a thing I do. Watching other people react to their first time seeing the song, it's quite a great thing.
I think I'm going to record a reaction video for you.
That would be so great.
I think that would be fun.
Oh my God, that would be you recording a reaction video to Silk Sonic would be. That's. I didn't know things could get this good because I've had a hard week and I was pretty depressed this week because I realized, oh my God, I might die soon. But this would be, if I was to die soon, this would be one last thing that would make me happy.
Don't die soon.
Anyway, that's enough of this nonsense.
Who do we have on the show today?
First, we're bringing back a guest we had on earlier this season, Desmond Meade. You may remember Desmond led the fight to re-enfranchise ex-felons in Florida and wanted to have him back on because that same fight to take away voting rights that he's fighting against is happening all over the country, specifically in Arizona and Georgia. And last week, Governor Ron DeSantis denied Desmond's request for a pardon for the second time.
And after we catch up with Desmond, we're going to talk to Soledad O'Brien. Soledad is one of the country's leading broadcast journalists, a veteran of NBC, CNN, HBO, MSNBC. And now she's got a new series airing on BET called Disrupt and Dismantle. Desmond Meade is president of the Florida Rights Restoration Committee.
In 2018, Desmond led the campaign for Amendment 4, the grassroots initiative that changed the Florida Constitution so that former felons who had served their time and returned as citizens would have the right to vote.
For that work, he was named by Time Magazine as one of its 100 most influential people.
He's also written a book called Let My People Vote, My Battle to Restore the Civil Rights of Returning Citizens. And I guess his biggest honor is being invited on this show twice in one season.
And one of us showed up for the interview.
Mm.
It was great talking to Desmond, so let's get him in here. Desmond, it's so great to have you back on Politically Reactive. I should let you know that my esteemed colleague, W. Kamau Bell, may miss this interview, might show up for the end. He is getting a COVID test. So let's hope everything works out and I see him again soon.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for him.
I'm happy you're back on, but I'm also frustrated for the reason you're back on. Governor Ron DeSantis, who's a member of the Florida Executive Board of Clemency, last week blocked your pardon for a second time, and he claims it's because of your dishonorable discharge from the military. But I'm assuming we all believe that's bullshit, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, sadly, I'm, you know, just a victim of, or a casualty, I should say, of this partisan back and forth that's going on between him and our Secretary of Agriculture. What you see with me being denied my pardon is actually an example of what we see going on around the country, right? When these politicians are going back and forth with each other, the people that suffer are just regular everyday people.
So the agriculture commissioner, is it Nikki Fried?
Yes, Nikki Fried.
Nikki Fried, a Democrat.
She's a Democrat. And she's been really pushing the governor on a lot of things, you know, not just around clemency, but on various issues. And, you know, from the very beginning, they've been, you know, trading barbs with each other. It was crazy because when you looked at the clemency hearing, you would see that this man was giving away pardons. In one case, He gave a pardon to someone who didn't even ask for a pardon, right?
Oh, my God.
In other cases, he gave somebody a pardon that wasn't even there, right?
Oh, my God.
Wasn't even there. And so, you know, the way how he was giving it out like it was candy, you know, but then when he came to me, had some issues, was problematic. And at the beginning of every clemency hearing, and I don't care where you go in the country, it's basically the same. Clemency, right, or considerations for clemency or a pardon, right, is focused more on what you've done after you have, you know, committed your crime and served your time, right? And so what they're looking to see is, have you so-called rehabilitated? How have you turned your life around? Have you become an asset to the community? You know, what have you done since you served your time? For this governor to really harp on, you know, something that happened in 1990, okay, It was pretty telling. And you know that was an excuse, you know. But I'm going to tell you, Harry, to be very open with you, at the end of the day, it was hard for me to remain in a space where I was disappointed, because something great did happen, that they did revise the clemency policies that now will impact hundreds of thousands of returning citizens in the state of Florida, to include myself, right? And so I think that the bigger picture is that these hundreds of thousands of individuals now, rather than just having their voting rights restored because of Amendment 4, now have their civil rights restored in whole, which means, matter of fact, I can give you a great example. You know, Amendment 4 passed. I was able to get my voting rights restored, but I still couldn't practice law because I can't sit for the Florida bar until my civil rights have been restored. Or I still couldn't buy or even rent a house, right? I'm having a hard time doing that because a lot of HOAs have restrictions that would bar me from owning or even renting a home until my civil rights have been restored. And so the automatic restoration of civil rights is a huge win, because now it gives, you know, hundreds of thousands of returning citizens an expanded opportunity to seek better employment, to get occupational licenses, and to even be able to provide safe and affordable housing for their family members and for themselves. And so, listen, if hundreds of thousands of people, if them benefiting means that I have to suffer a minor setback, hey, I'm willing to rock with that.
That was decided during the hearing. Wow.
Because of the policy changes, I now have my civil rights automatically restored. So now I can start practicing to get ready to apply to the Florida bar. Now I can go out and don't worry about HOA restrictions. Now I can go and I can try to find a house for my family, you know, to live. You know, and so these opportunities are great. The only thing I don't have is a pardon. And the two things that separates or distinguishes a pardon from the restoration of civil rights is, number one, a pardon forgives you for what you've done. And then number two is that a full pardon allows you now the right to bear arms.
I don't want to dwell on it for too long because, you know, you're right. There's so much that was gained. Do you feel like there's a degree of retribution involved, too, because of all the activism you've done regarding voting rights? Do you think it gets that petty?
I think that most definitely would have played a role in it, you know. And you see it a lot across the country that folks, you know, just by advocating for something, that they're attacked or people exact retribution on them, right? And that's kind of unfair because no one, if I'm not attacking you, right, but I'm attacking the issue, then you shouldn't take it personal. As a matter of fact, you should commend that, because when you talk about this country, when you talk about democracy, that's what it's all about, right? People speaking up when they see something is wrong. And in cases where politicians do not have the courage to move on the issue, then the people should rightfully so take matters in their own hands and try to move on it. To retaliate against people doing that, I think, is unpatriotic.
Following the 2020 election, we're seeing attempts to restrict access to voting in states across the country. Is that happening in Florida right now?
Yes, it is happening in Florida. One of the main things, like, for instance, during the election, you had places like the Amway Arena, where the Orlando Magic play, Tampa Bay Stadium, the baseball team. You had also the Jacksonville Jaguars, where these stadiums were used as drop-off locations for people to be able to drop off their mail-in ballots, right? there's legislation out here right now that would prevent that from happening. In the past, I think, you know, when you request a mail-in ballot, you would get it for multiple election cycles. And now they're saying, no, you have to apply for a mail-in ballot every election cycle. You know, and so it's just like little nuances. You know, they're not just going to come out and just stab you. You know, they're going to engage in what they call a death by a thousand cuts, you know. And they're going to cut here, little there. You know, and basically it's all designed to actually deflate the amount of enthusiasm for voting. I mean, what we've seen, record turnout.
That's right.
You know, and it wasn't like we didn't have the best candidates, but people showed up to vote, and we showed up to vote in the midst of a pandemic. Then we also have legislation that actually would, I would say, make it almost a crime to participate in the protest, to demonstrate, and then give people a wide degree of latitude for harming someone that's involved in the protest.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
So if you're wondering what Desmond is talking about, well, on the first day of the new session of the Florida legislature, Ron DeSantis made his State of the State address complete with lyrics from a Merle Haggard song. Governor Ron made what he calls, quote, anti-riot legislation a top priority. Florida's ACLU calls it anti-protest legislation that's aimed at silencing dissent following the racial justice protests of 2020. Rioting is already against the law in Florida. If three or more people with common intent, quote, intentionally execute a tumultuous disturbance of the peace, end quote, they can be charged with a third-degree felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. This law, HB1/SB484, would make it so anybody participating in a protest declared riotous can face felony charges. Doesn't matter if the protest started peacefully or is mostly peaceful. Doesn't matter if you had nothing to do with violence or disorder. If you're part of the assembly, you could face the punishments now reserved only for rioters. It also creates protections for counter-protesters that could encourage violence. If a counter-protester injures or kills a protester in an assembly deemed a riot, they would be able to use that as a defense against civil liability, even if the person they attacked was completely peaceful. If this bill had been enforced in Charlottesville, the ACLU says the white supremacists who drove into protesters and killed Heather Heyer would have been able to use this defense. This is a crackdown on protest, period. And black and brown protesters will inevitably be hit hardest. Get all the details and ways to take action at the Florida ACLU's website. That's ACLUFL.org. ACLUFL.org.
And so there are things that's out there that, once again, like I said, it flies in the face of democracy. You know, we've seen it when President Obama first won his election. You know, I guess it was too many African Americans that came out to vote. And the next thing you know, you've seen a barrage of legislation that was specifically designed to curtail participation in democracy. Elected officials should be doing everything within their power to expand access to the ballot box, right? You know, we talk about my country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty. Well, part of that, and at the heart of that, I should say, is a vibrant election season. Man, we should be making Election Day a holiday, right? We should be making sure that people are automatically registered to vote. We should be making sure that people have unencumbered access to the ballot box, right? Because when more people participate in our democracy, it becomes more vibrant. You know, it is what it is. What was most important to me was that people who never voted before voted for the first time. Matter of fact, I voted in my very first presidential election last year, right? And there were people who we used to complain about that didn't engage in elections. They showed up this year, right? And so there was a record number of first-time voters, record number of young voters. What is there not to be happy or excited about? You know, but of course, you got some folks that, once again, are threatened. Talking about voting and registering people to vote is not something that we're going to be doing only during the election season. Man, listen, we're doing it right now. If we're handing out a mask and sanitizer, you best believe we're talking to that person about why voting is important. If we're handing out food at a food giveaway line, you best believe we're talking to people about why it's important for them to vote. If we're at a COVID testing site, right now, somebody should be talking to Kamau about registering to vote. Make sure he's registered to vote. And if he comes and says that no one talked to him about registering to vote, then we've got to tighten up on that location and make sure that there are people there talking to folks. Matter of fact, just the fact that you're taking a COVID exam or getting a vaccine is reason enough to understand or to see how important it is for you to vote, right? Voting is the difference between life and death. And we are experiencing things right now that's a direct result of our level of voter participation.
What you're telling me just reinforces my belief that democracy is no friend to the right. As someone who defends voting rights on the state level, what would the passage of the new federal voting rights legislation, H.R. 1, mean for your efforts in Florida?
Wow. You know, that's a great question. And let me say, can I change your phrase a little bit, right? Democracy is not a friend to the wrong, right?
There you go. There you go.
To those that are wrong and want to do wrong, democracy is not a friend to them. But if you want to do right, you know what I'm saying, then you're going to embrace democracy. And so when you look at H.R. 1, I think, really speaks to, this is about more than just voting. This is about what democracy is about. This is about expanding access and making sure that every able-bodied American, right, has an opportunity to participate in their democracy. And remember, it is our democracy. It doesn't belong to the politicians. It belongs to us because the power originated with us individually, right? We have that power. And so I think H.R. 1 helps to really start creating a narrative that I think talks more about how democracy is something that you should aspire to be a part of rather than feel that you are forced to be a part of it or you have to be a part of it. No, you should want to be a part of this. It should be a part of our livelihood. I think H.R. 1 speaks more than just the act of voting. You know, I think it speaks to a much broader concept that we don't really talk about that much.
I'm just so curious, now that you have most of your rights back, are you going to practice law again soon? Like, what does that look like?
Well, you know what? Number one on my mind right now is, and this is something that folks should get excited about, right? Because, you know, Amendment 4, when Amendment 4 passed, over 1.4 million people was given a pathway to be able to register to vote. You know, our Florida legislature enacted a statute that now required the payment of fines and fees before you can register to vote. And that impacted about 774,000 people, right? I don't know about you, Harry, but I could do the math. Can Kamau do math? Is he good at math? I don't know. But if he's not good at math, I'm going to help all y'all out. 1.4 million minus 774,000 leaves over 500,000 individuals who do not have outstanding fines and fees, which means that today, right now, not only do over 500,000 people in Florida have the right to vote, but they have their civil rights back as well. And so they can go and they can buy homes. They can expand their employment opportunities. And guess what? Just like the Juneteenth, you know, when slaves in Galveston, you know, they didn't find out they were free until 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. So I anticipate that there's over 500,000 people in Florida right now who don't even know they're free yet, right? Mm. And my number one order of business is to let them know, hey, y'all's free. Y'all's free, right? Y'all can vote. Y'all can go buy your house. You can get better jobs. Let's go ahead and take advantage of it. And so we're focusing it on, like I said, if there's a food line out there, if there's a vaccine line, if there's a COVID testing line, guess what? There's also going to be a packet from the FRRC with face masks, sanitizers, and a card that encourages people to scan the QR code to register to vote or to sign up for fines and fees assistance.
Desmond, Kamau just got here, so we got to stop talking shit about him.
It wasn't me, Kamau.
Oh, I know. It's on tape.
If people are going to talk shit about me, I'd rather be a righteous person like you, Desmond, so I'm okay with that.
Did anybody ask you about registering to vote? where you at?
No.
See
no,
what I'm
no.
saying? Harry, these are the kind of things that we need to be engaged in right now.
Yeah.
Can't wait for election season because that's when things come more transactional and it's less authentic, right? We ought to be engaging as folks are going through this period now where folks are suffering, right? Folks are scared. This is the perfect time to remind them about the importance of voting and why they should be registered. Why they should be going out to the polls.
I do have a question, and I don't know if you covered this, but like I feel like one of the things that we have to do right now, we're starting to see it. Like when you see somebody like Cori Bush being a congressperson from St. Louis, that we have to get different people in these offices. And the thing you're dealing with is Governor Ron DeSantis, as I'm sure his name has come up in here, who yes. is one of the who is one of the poster children of bad governance, especially through COVID. Mm-hmm. Not even what he's gone on with all this other stuff. But would you see yourself running for office at some point? Mm. Could you see yourself getting there?
Yeah, I can see that. You know,
okay.
I can see that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, listen, I was telling folks that there were two things that COVID-19 did for me, right? And I think it should have done for a lot of people. Number one, it clearly demonstrated how voting is literally the difference between life and death, right? That's one. The other thing it did was that it was able to show us that there is a distinction, a very clear distinction between a politician and a public servant, right? When politicians are involved, this country is divided. There's a lot of hatred and fear, and people die. When public servants are involved, right, there's opportunity for the country to come together along the lines of humanity and people live. And the key thing here is that a public servant would never allow partisan politics to trump the needs of the people. And you see it. You see it in even like in gun control and so many other issues that the masses are crying out for help. But because of partisan politics, these cries are left unanswered. And so, if nothing else, we know that because voting is the difference between life and death, we've got to get out and vote. And then when we do vote, we need to select people who are more inclined to be public servants than politicians.
When you said that, Desmond, I was thinking about the fact that this story I saw that just came out of Mississippi, where the governor of Mississippi, another governor who would be the poster child for bad governance, Tate Reeves, who is turning down money to expand Medicaid, even though it would help many of the poorest people in his state. And Mississippi is literally the poorest state in the union.
We've seen that happen with in Florida when Governor Rick Scott was the governor. You know, turned down money. Not only for Medicaid, but he turned down money to strengthen our transportation infrastructure. Mm. You know, and it was all political. It was all political, you know. And so, you know, yeah, we need more people that's gonna run for office, man. That are more concerned about what's happening with the people than what's happening with the party.
You know, I know there's a lot of things that have to happen, but I would love you to be that person. And when you are that person, you got my endorsement. And I don't endorse a lot of people, but you got my endorsement.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, my brother.
I mean, you got my endorsement life.
I'm putting that in my pocket.
Yeah.
Right next to my heart. Right next to my heart. Now more than ever, you know, we just need to continue to show love to our fellow man. And we don't have to tear each other down to advance. You know, we really don't. And the other thing is that we don't have to, I don't think we have to deny somebody in order for us to get something. You know what I'm saying? When you talk about public safety, you know, even look at public safety, you know, where in order for police officers to be safe, then we have to lose something and not feel safe, right? And I do think that there's a way to where both sides or everybody can get something, but also contribute something to the collective betterment of our community, right? Rather than just give me, and I'm going to take from you so I could have more, and that's when I'm happy. No, we can't function, continue to function like that.
Well, Desmond, thank you for coming by today. I feel weird closing it out since I just got here, but thank you for coming by today.
That's how we do. I started, you ended, it works. It works.
That's all right.
Y'all tag team me today, so that was a good one, too. That was a good one,
okay,
too.
That's good. Well, Desmond, you know this. You're a lot, so it takes a lot of people. Well, thank you, sir, and I look forward to talking to you again.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Desmond Mead is president of the Florida Rights Restoration Committee, an organization run by people with felony convictions to expand their voting rights and civil liberties. Learn more and give your support at FloridaRRC.com. That's FloridaRRC.com.
Desmond tells the story in his book, Let My People Vote, My Battle to Restore the Civil Rights of Returning Citizens.
Coming up, we talk to Soledad O'Brien about her new BET series and about understanding and uprooting white supremacy. It's called Disrupt and Dismantle.
Soledad O'Brien is an Emmy Award-winning journalist who has anchored and reported for NBC, CNN, MSNBC, and HBO.
Oh, that's funny. Everybody in that interview has won an Emmy, right, Hurry?
Shut up, Kamau.
Now she has her own production.
I said it too real, right?
It was really fun. I was trying to roll with it, but it was too funny. Now she has her own production company. She hosts her podcast, Very Opinionated, with Soledad O'Brien, and anchors the weekly public affairs show, Matter of Fact.
And we've got her here to talk about her new documentary series about white supremacy and how to root it out. It's called Disrupt and Dismantle, and it's on BET, airing Wednesdays at 11 p.m.
Let's talk to Soledad. Thank you for doing Politically Reactive. We both really appreciate it.
Of course. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So your new show on BET, Disrupt and Dismantle, I feel like is the kind of show that BET has needed for a long time. So I'm glad you're doing it there.
It's interesting. You know, when we did a series called Black in America on CNN, and my friends at BET were like, we cannot believe that CNN did that. Like, that's a BET show. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, these things are fixable. You can always do it. They've done a really interesting job. I do hope we get another season out of it or a couple of seasons out of it. Because, of course, you winnow 100 ideas down to just, you know, for a 6-part series.
When I saw that you had a show, first of all, I was like, well, of course, you should have a show. You have multiple shows and you got room for more. But then I thought at BET, I was like, I feel like there's always a conversation amongst Black folks in whatever this is, media, who are like, why isn't BET doing more of that kind of thing? Like, they had BET News for a while. So it feels like a very, like, you specifically doing it feels like, there we go.
Yeah, no, and I think it came about after the George Floyd killing. Like, I think there was a real conversation of what do we need to do in this era that hasn't kind of existed before. So, yeah, they were very hands-on in what they wanted, which was interesting, right? It was not a, hey, go out and do what you feel and just deliver it. And two interesting requests. One, deep into history. They wanted a deep dive to not just do a redlining is the problem, you know, bad schools are the problem. Like, we want to really understand it. And then number two, they wanted to have solutions. Like, do not just tee it up and then walk away like, isn't this terrible? This is so sad. It has to be, how do we fix this? What did this woman do? How is she fixing her problem? What can people who don't live in Dallas or Nashville or Chicago or wherever, what can they do if they have a similar issue? And I thought both of those actually were really good criticisms of the doc that we did for CNN, which was an amazing doc, but it kind of didn't dig enough into history, right? It sort of showed people where they were today, and it didn't explain and connect the dots. And it certainly didn't give anybody any sense of like, well, if you want to understand such and such, here's what you can proactively do. So I thought those were two really good fixes.
I also think Disrupt and Dismantle is a great way to describe your actions on Twitter.
I come in peace. You know, I actually, when I go through my Twitter, like, I definitely do go after certain things, and I definitely try to cut people off the knees when I think they're doing something wrong. But a lot of my Twitter is actually elevating things that I think are interesting. I would argue 72% of my Twitter is like, I like this story. This is interesting. Here's something you probably haven't heard about. Like, truly, just kind of different stories and different you know, takes on something that's happening. And then the other, you know, 25% is this idea of like, what the actual fuck is happening? And why are these people and why are we so stupid? And how do we, you know, how do we make this stop?
You follow way too many people on Twitter. I just want to be clear about that.
But, you know, I took that advice from a rapper, which was really good, but it's, there was a rapper named Becky G who I did a documentary on. And she said to me, anybody who follows me, I follow them. She said, you know, everybody likes to follow the important people, but the people you should be following are the people who want to hear what you have to say and want to invest their time in you. And I was like, oh, that's such good advice. A lot of journalists just follow journalists. And I think that's a mistake. First of all, journalists are so boring and their jokes are terrible. they really are awful. And there's just so, you know, so you really hear different conversations happening. And that's why I use my platform to kind of elevate, like, this thing is happening over here. These teachers are talking about this. These people who are working at the CDC are talking about this. This is what's happening in public health. This is what's happening for, you know, students. So I really like that. But then it can be incredibly overwhelming at times. And you do get on stupid threads about Mr. Potato. I mean, I guess I'm just Mr. Potato Head now. And I was like, oh my God, this has got to end. How is this destroying my feed? The genderless Mr. Potato Head no.
They're potatoes. Potatoes don't have genders. They're potatoes.
America, first of all, we call them freedom fries, and they do have genders.
They have gender and nationality.
Are you even an American? Are you even from here?
No, he's from Queens.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. How are you everywhere, Soledad? I feel like I've seen you everywhere on everything.
It's so weird. I'm trying to work. You know what I do? I get up relatively early. I try to go horseback riding in the morning.
Oh.
There I and then I basically come home and sort of, you know, work out of my little office-y type setup, my space plus a ring light plus my fake flowers. The only upside of working for yourself is that you get to create an environment that you like, right? Like literally, like if you cannot say, well, you know, at least I like working for myself. Mm-hmm. Like if it's a miserable thing, but you're in your own home, working out of your own office, like that's bad. And I just remember thinking, like, I will never, ever work in a place where I don't like the people. I will never, ever. I will never work for people I don't like. I will never, you know, and I think if you start really thinking about it that way, you end up having interesting partnerships with people that you like, and you get to work on a bunch of different things. Because I get in a great ride every morning. I got four kids. I run around. I do a little tiny bit of, I wouldn't say cooking. I do assembling.
I do. Like, I'm an assembler.
I have a life. I'm not just like slogging away day in and day out. But, you know, but some days we're really busy.
You went to Hilton Head Island in South Carolina to look at how the Gullah people are losing control of their ancestral lands. It's such a fascinating history. And also I'm trying to phrase this properly, but like you get to see a particular moment in time where language and culture developed and some degree of isolation allowed that to continue and not be destroyed. And also, like, in this country's history, who has land given to them, who has land taken away from them is like a key element in the racial wealth gap.
Ooh, pick me. I can answer that one.
Yeah. I just want, before you answer, Soledad, I just want to reveal to the listeners, this is a key moment where I find out that Hari has not watched my show, United Shades of America, where I talk to the Gullah Geechee people. So apparently he's only read about it.
Or has not watched any past episodes of my show, matter of fact, where we've done a couple of different but actually it's a very complicated story, right?
Hold up. Wait a minute.
All right, everybody, let's talk about the Gullah Geechee people. It starts with the name. They are referred to as the Gullah Geechee, the Gullah, sometimes the Geechee people. Basically, they are African Americans who live in the low country region of the U.S. states of Georgia, South Carolina, and all the way down to Florida on the coastal plain and on the sea islands. Basically, their history is very interesting and unique because while they were enslaved by the white folks, after they were freed from slavery, the white folks left the sea islands and left the regions, and the people of the black folks of that region were allowed to hold on to their culture from their African roots and also develop new cultures here, but independent of white folks. Doesn't that sound amazing? They even have their own language called Gullah, which is a little bit English, a little bit African, and a lot of just some AAV, that's African-American vernacular English.
In the 20th century, some plantations were redeveloped as resort or hunting destinations for wealthy white visitors. Resort development on the Sea Islands has greatly increased property values, threatening to push the Gullah off lands their families have owned since emancipation. They have fought back against uncontrolled development on the islands through community action, the courts, and the political process. In 2006, the U.S. Congress passed the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor Act, which provided $10 million over 10 years for the preservation and interpretation of historic sites relating to Gullah culture.
So in Hilton Head Island, which was overwhelmingly Black people back in the day, people who were freed slaves got land, bought their land, and some, you know, have deeds to their land. But the way they kind of left their land to their heirs was in this heir's property, which is great. Every heir gets access to the land, but bad because you could have 150 people who have access generation after generation after generation. And maybe 140 of that 150 don't live on the land. And the way you can trigger an heir's property sale is just to express an interest in it and can force the sale. And of course, with land, we think of like, this is amazing. This land on Hilton, waterfront land in Hilton Head Island is worth, the one piece I was looking at, $20 million, right? I mean, to $38 million, like tons of money. But people live in trailers often on these lands, right? Because they actually can't leverage the land to work for them because there are so many heirs, they can't go to a bank and say, I own 35 acres, it's worth tons and tons of money. So they're kind of stuck. And so, and obviously people who are developers want to get in on this and figure out how to trigger a land sale. So they might go to an heir, one of the 100 heirs, and talk them into selling, putting the land up for sale, which they can get then for a song. It might be worth $25 million or $30 million. They'll get it for $4 million. If you're a developer, amazing deal. The other thing that can happen is because Hilton Head has grown so much and there's so much development, the property taxes have gone up. And so you don't really own your land. You have a trailer on your land. And so it's very hard to pay the property taxes on that land, especially, I mean, some of these folks have been on there, you know, they're elderly people, right? They're not going to suddenly be able to pay $10,000 a year in property taxes when 2 years ago or 5 years ago it was $2,000. I mean, the bigger question is, do the Gullah people matter to Hilton Head Island, right? Like, do you care or not? And is the answer like, listen, we don't care. We need a golf course. We need a nice hotel. And that's what we care about. Because either you care about preserving your culture or you don't. And they have such a fascinating culture, the language, the food. I mean, just the way in which things were done, living off the land. It's fascinating. And there's some restaurateurs now kind of in the, I'd say kind of across the South, who are really elevating the Gullah cuisine, et cetera, et cetera. But the big question for Hilton Head is, do you care? Because if you care, then you say, okay, these people own their land. How do we preserve it? How do we make sure that you can't sell this property in easily out from under the people who live there? But if you don't care and you just care about developers, then you don't.
Chicago was, is, and will forever be a gangster-ass city. And the police department is the biggest gang in the city.
You had a recent episode of Disrupt and Dismantle where you look at police reform and the movement for self-policing, which obviously is very controversial and not well understood.
There we go. That's it.
Between his busy schedule as a father of four and running his own martial arts studio, Mark Quinn leads a citizen-led neighborhood patrol. I stopped by his studio to learn more.
Thanks for having me to your studio.
Thank you for blessing the studio with your presence.
Oh my goodness, my pleasure.
I appreciate this moment.
Of course. A lot of the work you do when you're not in the studio is in your community. Tell me about that.
A lot of my work consisted of mentorship. I teach free martial art classes in Bronzeville. Along with that, we would do a community patrol or neighborhood watch, which is what we do now.
What does that consist of exactly? Describe it for me.
We monitor the blocks. We monitor police activity. We monitor the elderly. We monitor the homeless. We monitor any young girls or elderly women or men or children that's outside past the time.
So can I come along with you as the patrol happens tonight?
Please, I'd be honored.
I'd like to see it.
Did you see people and models that made you think this transformation can happen in this country?
you know, we were in Chicago, and it was just small. It was fledgling. I think there's a lot of passion there, but they're not well-funded. They're not well-supported. And I think they get just enough funding to kind of get by, but not enough funding to become a real thing. You know, but Chicago's a weird city, and Chicago's a crazy city in a lot of ways. We did the story of Anjanette Young. You remember that woman who was, they burst into her house. They basically left her with naked for 13 minutes while they were in it. I mean, and you know, it's so interesting talking to her, and they'll pay her out money. I mean, we should take bets right now on how much they're going to end up paying her. It'll be, I bet, $10 million at least, maybe more. I remember thinking, you know, talking to her, and it's such a distressing thing. And I think this happens to people of color a lot, where you sort of, it dawns on you like, wow, they just don't even think I'm like an animal, like I'm below whatever the category of, you know, it was so upsetting to her, this idea, like, you could leave a human being, a woman, standing there naked while people are walking around her apartment searching for a guy who clearly pretty quickly is not there, not going to show up. And she's saying the whole time, he's not here. This is, you have got the wrong place. And there's not a single person who's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Right? I mean, I would like to think that all of us would be one minute and 22 seconds in, like, oh my gosh. Oh, hold on. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's get this lady a robe. Take the cuffs off. Let's put the robe back on. And you could put the whatever. Like, where is the little shred of human decency? And I think for her to see, if she were a dog who'd been chained up in the apartment, three people would have run over to make sure that dog was okay. But it was brutal. It just, and hearing that in her voice, as a church going lady, has worked as a social worker, right? She would say, like, she has been a good American citizen for a long time. That stuff just, I find so depressing. I really do. I find it so hard.
And even though you know you live in a world that is racist and a country that is racist and you deal with racism all day long, sometimes it is so shocking that you're just like on your back foot for a second before you can even respond to it.
It's so painful. Like, did not one of you, and I don't remember the number, some large number of people in the apartment, but not one person was like, well, this is crazy. Get her a robe.
Yeah.
Get her a blanket. Like, just not one person thought to maintain her dignity or her humanity.
Well, I mean, this is, to me, it gets down into like the, just the culture of policing, specifically in this country, that there's something endemic to that culture that breeds that instinct out of people. That I would imagine that there are cops who go in there going like, I am here to help people. But something about being a police officer means that like one officer doesn't cover her up. And the second one who was like, I guess he didn't cover up. I won't. You know what I mean? Like, it becomes like a thing where they seem to follow the instincts of the bad ones is what it
feels
like.
Well, there's that video, which I can't remember. Did it take place? Was it? What do I think it's in Buffalo? The elderly.
That's
man.
What I was thinking about. Yes. Right? Yep.
And you see the one officer who kind of does the bobble of like, oh, my gosh, there's a little old man. And he's clearly elderly. And you could see him bleeding from the head. Right. The blood. Yes. You can watch it seep out. And one officer kind of stops to like, oh, my gosh. And the guy behind it kind of shoves him like, do not even think about that. Yes. And so when you say that, it really reminds me of that video of like, regardless of what your instinct is, there is this bigger culture of don't even.
It's really like the banality of evil, right? This is just like what Hannah Arendt was writing about regarding World War II, right? It's just like, I'm just doing my job and I'm loyal to my guys. And this is our team. And this is who we support, the end. And it kind of completely takes rest of society out. It's just, you're just worried about your club. Even when people say things like Blue Lives Matter, like, there are no blue people.
Well, come on. Well,
what are you talking about? It's a uniform.
Look at the Capitol, where they're literally chanting blue, like on January 6th, right? The insurrectionists are chanting Blue Lives Matter while beating a police officer with like the end of a flag, an American flag, right? It's just like, if you scripted that, people would be like, oh my gosh, a little too heavy on the symbolism.
It's like something that would have been in Crash or something. It's just a little bit too obvious. Yeah.
A little too much. And then today, or the other day, I guess, you have Senator Ron Johnson talking about how, you know, these protesters, they love America and they respect law authority and they would never break the law. You're like, literally no and no and no, right? But it is banal and it is almost so low level and pathetic, right? You just have to say a thing. You know, I think when Trump became president, we all started learning what gaslighting is and what that exactly means, you know, and And I think it's now become a real art for people. Where you just say the opposite, right? It just doesn't matter as long as you, do you have the flag? Do you have the visuals? Do you have enough of the narrative, right? Even though they're beating a police officer to death while chanting Blue Lives Matter, like none of that is going to be incongruous in people's heads, you know, because they're patriots.
Well, let's talk about the media's role in this, the greater media, the, you know, because one of the things that you, like you said earlier, that you will call people out in the media for framing things in ways you think are disingenuous. Many of those people might be your former coworkers.
Yeah. Today I got a call. I had tweeted something that was inaccurate. And Daniel Dale, who's a fact checker at CNN, sent me a note. He's like, this was wrong. And I was like, oh, thanks. I appreciate that. I actually hope that people, when you say this is not right, or you should think about it this way, or the way you're looking about this at it, this is wrong. I hope people say, yeah. And I think if you do a generic, some people in the media and not, hey, Soledad, I am telling you on this tweet, you are mistaken. You know, the only way to get me to actually understand and hear that and see what I've done wrong is to say it and explain it. You know, I think it has to be very targeted and specific. And listen, I think it's done for clicks. I used to really believe, right? If you're going to elevate a lie, right? If I say, President Trump says the moon is made of cheese, when we all know the moon's not made of cheese, right? At some point you say, wow, you either don't really understand how this works, or maybe you don't realize how many characters you get on Twitter, or maybe more likely the 99th time you do it, you're just trying to drive a narrative that's going to push people to click, right? And is it true? Sure. But are you elevating a lie? Yes. And if you're elevating a lie unintentionally, then you should apologize for it. But they're not, because it's an intentional. It really dawned on me at one point, like, oh, this is not accidental. People make mistakes all the time, right? You say something, you misunderstand the story, you misquote someone. I get it. I really do. But some of these things are very intentional. And when you elevate lies, why are you putting people on TV who lie? Why are you not framing them as this is a person who's been dishonest in the past? You should know that, because it's relevant to the conversation we're having.
Does it make your job harder to do if somebody gets their feelings hurt by the fact that you called them out and you run into them at the after hours journalist hangout or the award show?
I think I go to after hours.
I'm sure you don't. But I'm saying, like,
it doesn't really work like that. I don't think so. And I think it wouldn't, you know, part of the challenge is that so many of the things that they're doing are very public. It's not like I was at a dinner party and I heard this person say this thing, which I think BuzzFeed has actually done that. You know, I think it's like you just did an entire documentary on Melania Trump and didn't mention she's a birther. That's a big freaking miss. Sorry. And guess what? That's also lazy and it's wrong. And that deserves to be put on blast as this is wrong. I don't care if she likes me or hates me. It literally makes no difference in my life. And I'm fairly confident when I'm out riding my little horse, I'm not going to bump into her anywhere. So
I, I don't know. If you cover Melania Trump, you might also be a person who rides horses. I feel like that those could be circles, Venn diagrams that connect.
I am in West Palm Beach, and they did just give her a big old award here not too long ago. Yeah.
So you might run into that reporter at the stables.
You are absolutely right. So, you know, I don't know. I don't care. I really think, and listen, I've had people send me notes and they think that stories that I've done or ways that I framed things were really wrong. And sometimes I think they're right. Sometimes I listen. Sometimes I think they're wrong. These things are important. I think if you don't feel some way about it, if you just treat it all like a joke, right? The idea, the thing I find about Chris Elizzo, who's very annoying, is that the whole thing is a joke, right? It's just a joke. The whole thing is, it's like, yeah, fuck you, because you're not a person of color, right? So racist things don't bother you. People lying is irrelevant to you, right? It just doesn't matter to you. The joke about, you know, a lot of the sort of snitty, sassy way that he talks about things that are so important to people. Yeah, I get it. You don't know any dreamers. I understand. You don't care. You do not care about these immigration issues. They do not affect you at all, ever, day in and day out, right? So you can do, if Democratic candidates were Game of Thrones characters, because it's all a big freaking joke. I get it, but it's not to me. It's not. These people are my relatives or my scholars that we send through college or my friends. And so those things do matter. And so when everybody's making a joke about it, those people should be pilloried, because it's not funny. It's this idea that it just doesn't matter because they're usually middle-aged, middle-class white dudes is just inappropriate. And it's such a typical blinders for the media, right? Like this, you know, there's certain things that are very funny and they're often things that matter to people of color.
Well, it often feels like watching cable news now, it almost feels like everyone is trying to do their version of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Like, it's like, oh, The Daily Show was so good at presenting a comedy show with a news format and making jokes and getting, and people would say, like, I get all my news from The Daily Show. And so now it just feels like, okay, everyone's doing their version of The Daily Show.
Which is so interesting, right? Because the world's moved on to Trevor Noah. Like the Daily Show is not The Daily Show. It actually has moved into a much more thoughtful take and explanation, which by the way is what media should be doing. You know, we do this show for Hearst that we syndicate around the country and we just explain stuff. What is gerrymandering? So we talk about the first, your First Amendment right. What does that mean exactly? When you swear, when you're sworn into office, what are you swearing to do? You know, I mean, and I got to tell you, I've spent a lot of time covering this and those are all things that I was like, yeah, what exactly is that? I mean, I probably could BS my way through it, but like kind of sort of hit it, but I don't really know. And so we wanted to do a show that kind of broke it down. I think he does that really well, right? On the daily, on Trevor Noah's show, he definitely like walks you through an explanation of, let me explain the world to you. And I think that the Jon Stewart model is old. And I agree. I think everybody's trying to do a model that the original itself has moved on.
So you spoke at congressional hearings on media, disinformation, and extremism a few weeks ago.
TV, cable news in particular, relies on the cheap and easy booking of talking heads who exchange colorful barbs, entertaining outbursts, and sometimes peddle outright fiction. It's only gotten worse as reporters and anchors chase ratings, toss aside objectivity to divide us into false categories, I believe, of left and right, manipulating facts and debating the liars they booked for their very own shows.
That's my nightmare, being called to speak before Congress.
I was so nervous because what would be more embarrassing than like embarrassing yourself in front of Congress? I was so nervous. And also, here's an interesting little factoid. You basically have to sit for 4 hours, which I didn't really calculate. Like, you cannot move and you can't turn your camera off because then it counts as you leaving the meeting. You're not part of the meeting anymore.
Wow.
So yeah. And you start by submitting like a 9-page document about what you're going to talk about. Then you have to cut that down to a 5-minute sort of presenting remarks. And then the other day they emailed me with follow-up questions. I'm like, we are done. I'm done. I have homework now to give to Congress. How crazy is that? But I was very nervous about it.
Why do you think they called you? What did you feel like you brought to the conversation?
I don't know. I think it was because they knew I would be very blunt about some of the challenges I saw in the media. And I'm self-employed. So I think it frees you up to say, like, this is a problem. This is a serious problem, and name names. It was weird though, because if you were going to set up a meeting to solve a problem, right? If you were like, listen, we're all going to meet next week for 4 hours. We're going to dig into this problem. This is not how you would do it. And I was very honored to be asked. Like, I was excited. I wouldn't do it again, I don't think. But because it's everybody presents, right? And then they ask the questions of their witnesses. I was one of a couple of witnesses. But it's not really a fact finding, right? It's not okay, so we're not going to agree on this part because clearly, you know, but over here, we are going to agree on this over here. It just, it's not really teed up. We've all been in meetings, right? Where you're like, oh, this is a meeting, but it's not really a meeting. Right? And someone's like, you know, at the end of this meeting, we're going to do this. You're like, no, we're really not. We just got to check the boxes. And it was interesting to be part of it because I've never been a part of it. But normally we would say, okay, we're not agreeing on everything, but there are three categories that are misinformation, that are dangerous. Let's talk about them. What should we be doing? Let's start there on these things we agree on. So that was, it was a little weird because it made me a little disheartened for America and how we get to things, because it wasn't a real conversation. But I didn't mess up. I didn't embarrass myself. And that was actually my only goal.
My fear would be I'd sit down and suddenly I'd look up and see Katie Porter with her whiteboard. Right. Okay, Mr. Bell.
So do you agree with this? Are you saying?
No.
Well, what you're saying is you're stealing from the American people. Is that what you're saying? Yes. Yes.
Whatever you say. Yeah.
Whatever you say.
Most Congress people aren't embarrassed to embarrass themselves in front of Congress. So I don't think our standards are
Yeah. I actually had a funny exchange. I can't remember who the congressman was, but he said, so you covered Ferguson, hands up, don't shoot. And I'm like, no, never went to Ferguson, didn't cover it. I actually had left but he clearly thought I had. So that was going to be you could tell it was like,
yeah.
Usually people stick with their own witnesses, right? So the Republicans ask the Republican witness question. So very rarely do you have someone challenge you. So I was kind of like, no, I left doing daily television at that point. So I've never been to Ferguson. And then he said, well, you tweeted hands up, don't tweet. I said, I tweet a million things. I cannot confirm what I tweeted. Like, what? Where are we going with this? What are we talking about? And then that was it. He moved on to the Republican witness and he left.
This isn't going well for me. Never mind.
So you have four teenagers at home and I think...
Breaking news.
We all talk about race a lot and we think about race a lot. How do your kids view race or talk about race? Like, is there a fundamental difference of how they view that compared to how we view that? Because we can't help but carry the baggage we carry because it's part of what makes us who we are.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think teenagers generally, they're constantly morphing and changing, right? So a kid who tells you this with tremendous, being incredibly definitive about it 2 weeks later is changing their mind. So I'll frame it with that. It really depends. I mean, I remember my older daughter was very interesting. We were applying for her to get into schools in New York City, would always ask about the racial breakdown of the school. And I'm like, let's just get in first. Like, these are all private schools. This is not a good conversation to have because I can tell you the racial breakdown.
It's not good. It's not good.
So let me tell you, don't ask. But she was always like very, I mean, I think that was always her thing. My other daughter, my second daughter, used to say, when she was invited to go to like a girls of color event at the school, she's like, so none of my white friends are going to go. What does that mean? Why am I doing that? Why would I want to go? You know, like, and I think it was all age appropriate while they tried to figure it out. And for both of them, they've changed and shifted and, you know, and have argued sort of all sides of different conversations. I think that's very classic teenagerness. I don't know. I try to make sure that we're having an open conversation about this thing. And I talk a lot about the work I'm doing. My big concern with young people is that they look at data points and they don't understand history. So they don't understand why certain things happen, or they believe that certain, I mean, this is a group that thinks that Helen Keller doesn't exist because someone on TikTok told them that Helen Keller is you saw that, right? That there's a whole,
that's a thing.
Oh, there's a whole mythology on TikTok that Helen Keller doesn't exist. My daughter's literally like, does Helen Keller exist? I'm like, yeah.
Of all the people to erase.
I'm not sure it worked, but they were trying hard. But, you know, so I think to me, it's about having a constant conversation where you're going, you know, and you're always surprising them when you say, so, you know, when people came back from the war, they could get a grant so that they could go to school, unless you were Black. So, you know, grandma and grandpa wanted to move into this neighborhood, but they couldn't get a house because my mom was Black, you know? And so I think it's that kind of like, oh, that they just never think about that, you know, history, which again, back to our special is really what we were trying to do, like really make people understand. You realize when you look at these places that have extreme environmental racism, where all the heavy industry is located. At one point, a guy said to me, yeah, I wouldn't want to live there either. Well, guess what? If you take the redlining maps from the 40s in Dallas and you put them on top of where all the heavy, guess what happens? Take a guess. It's going to shock you. They kind of sort of match up, right? So obviously there's a connection between redlining and all these places where heavy industry was allowed to operate. Why don't those exist in equal numbers in, you know, more white neighborhoods and better neighborhoods? Well, you know, you think people want to move into places where there's heavy industry, or are they stuck there? This is where they're allowed to live. And so they do the best they can. And I think explaining those things that bring us to the stereotypes, why do Black families have less wealth? Is it just, you know, well, shoot, they're just not working hard enough at saving their money? Or, you know, can we talk about how wealth is transferred and how that's different than your income and what kind of money you get? You know, so I think that's what I've tried to do, is to have those kinds of conversations. So you're not dealing in mythology.
Well, Soledad, thank you for coming on Politically Reactive. We really appreciate it. So thank you for being out there. And, you know, I think you really do demonstrate you know, sometimes you take stands regularly and very clear personal stands. And I think it's a demonstration of how to do that. So I appreciate that.
I had to promise everybody, especially my children, I'd stop cursing because I really do.
Oh, come on.
Right? Where's the
that's how you, that's how you know you mean it.
Right?
Oh, yeah. His kid is very young, so he doesn't understand yet. I had my the other day I dropped an F-bomb and my nine-year-old was like, what was that? I'm sorry, what was that?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Soledad O'Brien's new documentary series is Disrupt and Dismantle. You can see it Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. on BET.
She also hosts the podcast Very Opinionated with Soledad O'Brien and anchors the weekly public affairs show Matter of Fact. That's it for this week. Thanks to Desmond Mead and Soledad O'Brien.
We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
Leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525.
What, you didn't hear it? Oh, it's 917-477-6525.
And keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
And please rate and review the show wherever you get your podcast. It gets the word out. And yes, we do read them because we make the time for your judgment.
Also, Matt sends them to us, so we can't help
but I wish he would send them out. Yeah.
As we talked about earlier in the show, support the Florida Rights Restoration Committee, Florida Rights Restoration Committee. And if you happen to live in a state that has a Republican governor, I'm pretty sure that Republican governor is trying to strip black and brown folks of their voting rights. So check in with some local activists in your state about what's going on there.
And this is the part where I promote us selfishly and look like an egomaniac. Kamau and I both have Netflix specials, Private School Negro and Warn Your Relatives. They're still very relevant because the world is still shitty, and that's where we step in.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And the Honorable W. Kamau Bell.
And the even more Honorable Hari Kondabolu.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger-Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Statton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
Brontez and I were both featured in Cultured Magazine. You should read our interviews.
The goal of showbiz is, the way I feel about it, or maybe it's the goal of life, is that the people that think you're a jerk, you're like, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Because there are people who definitely think you're a jerk, but you have to sort
all
of, I feel
of
like,
things,
at first I feel like when you're younger, it's like, well, at least I feel like I just want to be nice and I want everybody to like me. And then at some point you go, nah, I just want the people who I'm fine with thinking I'm a jerk to be the only people who think I'm a jerk.
I mean, it's part of it is like, why is this person a jerk to me? Because I said those things. Yeah, but I meant those things.
Yeah, exactly.
So then it's like, so I was talking about them. So fuck them. It kind of works. The math works out.
Yeah. So that's the goal of life.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.